Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Unmissable stories from around the globe from the BBC World Service.
My happy place. This is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 19th of February, these are our main stories. Israel has condemned comments by Brazil's president, accusing it of genocide in Gaza and likening its actions to those of Hitler. The US ambassador to Moscow has laid flowers to honour Alexei Navalny, President Putin's most prominent Russian opponent, who died in prison on Friday. Italy's highest court has ruled that it's illegal to send migrants who've arrived by sea back to Libya. Also in this podcast...
When I came to you with those calculations, we thought we might start a chain reaction that would destroy the entire world.
What happened?
I believe we did.
The annual BAFTA Film Awards in London have been dominated by the movie Oppenheimer, which has picked up 7 prizes, including Best Film, Best Director and Best Actor. We start with the conflict in Gaza. And there are growing numbers of nations who've expressed criticism at the way Israel is carrying out its attacks and the escalating number of Palestinians being killed. Last month, South Africa filed a genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And now the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, speaking in Ethiopia at the African Union summit, has taken the criticism to a new level. He likened Israel's operations in Gaza to the actions of Adolf Hitler during the Holocaust.
What's happening in the Gaza Strip with the Palestinian people has no parallel in history. In fact, it did happen when Hitler decided to kill the Jews.
Well, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the Brazilian leader had crossed a red line.
By comparing Israel's war in Gaza against Hamas, a genocidal terrorist organization, to the Holocaust, President Silva has disgraced the memory of 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis, and he's demonized the Jewish state like the most virulent anti-Semite. He should be ashamed of himself.
I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, and asked him what has been the general reaction to the Brazilian president's comments in Israel.
As you would imagine, Israelis are outraged at any suggestion that what they are doing in Gaza bears any resemblance at all to the murder of 6 million Jews by the Nazis in World War II. You know, it is a pretty extraordinary comparison. And so it is not at all surprising that from the president on down, we are hearing expressions of total outrage. You've already mentioned the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The president, Isaac Herzog, reminded people that they had found in Gaza a book published by Hamas which praised and glorified Hitler's ideology and the Holocaust, and he said that it was an immoral distortion of history to compare what Israel is doing to the Nazis. There were similar comments from the Defence Minister, Yoav Galant, and the Brazilian ambassador is likely to be summoned to the Foreign Ministry to explain himself. So I think from, you know, across the board, there is a sense of complete outrage because Israel simply does not accept any suggestion that what it is doing in the Gaza Strip that could be remotely compared to the actions of the Nazis.
Meanwhile, Paul, the Israeli government has been giving details about when it might launch its offensive in Rafah. What do we know?
Yeah, so this is a speech that was given today to a delegation of visiting presidents of major Jewish organizations from the United States. Benny Gantz, who's a member of the War Cabinet and a former chief of staff of the army, saying that if hostages are not freed by the beginning of Ramadan, which is in precisely 3 weeks, Israel will launch its offensive against the city of Rafah. The fighting, he said, would continue everywhere and include the Rafah area. He went on to say that Israel would act in a coordinated manner, facilitating, in his words, the evacuation of civilians in dialogue with our American and Egyptian partners. words which may add to the speculation that some people, some Palestinians in Gaza, may find themselves having to seek refuge outside the Gaza Strip, possibly in this walled enclosure that the Egyptians are building nearby on their side of the border. You know, this is obviously tough rhetoric designed to concentrate minds and to send a stark warning to Hamas that the full might of the Israeli military is going to be turned on Rafah within a matter of weeks if hostages are not released. So it could be part of a bargaining effort to try and force a deal on the release of hostages, or it could be, you know, a genuine warning that this offensive is coming and that Hamas should know that. And, you know, most Israeli politicians and military figures are on the same page here. They all say this is an assault which will happen.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Let's go back for a moment to look at President Lula's comments about Israel's actions in Gaza. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
While most people will condemn President Lula's reference to Hitler in the context of the Gaza conflict, his criticism of Israeli policies towards the Palestinians reflects the prevailing views of the left in Latin America. The political polarization of the past decade has pushed the left and the right to opposing sides on most foreign policy issues, from climate change and migration to war. Like the leaders of Venezuela, Nicaragua and Colombia, Mr. Lula was criticized for failing to condemn in strong terms Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He said at the time that both sides were keen to fight and added that it takes two to tangle. A dissonant left-wing voice in the region has been that of Gabriel Boric, the 38-year-old president of Chile. He has used strong words against Hamas and Israel and has also criticized the leaders of Russia and Nicaragua. Mr. Boric has urged Latin American leaders to speak out against the violation of human rights and international law wherever it happens.
Leonardo Rocha. The American ambassador to Moscow has laid flowers to honour Alexei Navalny, the prominent Russian opposition leader who died in a Siberian jail on Friday. The Russian prison service announced his death, saying that he'd collapsed after taking a walk. Mr. Navalny's supporters believe he was murdered. Our Eastern European correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reports.
Russia doesn't want acts of commemoration for Alexei Navalny to become acts of protest. So since he died, police have arrested dozens of people across the country, including a priest who wanted to lead a prayer service. Men in black hoods keep clearing away the flowers so that the scale of support for Navalny isn't obvious. But in Moscow, there are fresh flowers and more people pausing to remember a man who campaigned against corruption, against the Kremlin, and for change, and who was imprisoned for that. This woman described Navalny as a hero. She says he fought for Russia to be free and not a dictatorship. Another says he opened her eyes to what Russia is and to what it's doing in Ukraine. It was for denouncing the invasion of Ukraine that another opposition figure, Vladimir Kara-Murza, was imprisoned. Today, his wife Yevgenia told the BBC that in her view, Vladimir Putin has been left unchecked for too long.
All that impunity that lasted for decades led him to believe that he's somehow untouchable. And for as long as he's sitting in the Kremlin unchecked, we will see more warmonging, we will see more repression.
Navalny's body still hasn't been released to his family. There is still no information on the cause of his sudden death. So his political team are accusing the authorities of a cover-up. They don't trust them, especially since he was poisoned with a nerve agent 3 years ago. Navalny always said he was fighting for what he called the beautiful Russia of the future. As one of his aides put it today, he just wanted a country that was normal.
Sarah Rainsford. Italy's top court has ruled that sending migrants who arrived by sea back to Libya is unlawful. More than 80 migrants have been saved following two sea rescues in the Mediterranean over the last 24 hours. Alice Adley reports.
The court's decision to uphold the conviction of the unnamed captain of an Italian towboat, the Aso 28, is final. In 2018, he picked up 101 people, including children and pregnant women, from a rubber dinghy in the Mediterranean and returned them to Libya. Widespread migrant abuse has been extensively documented in Libya. In recent years, Italy and other European governments have taken an increasingly hard line on immigration amid a swell in support for right-wing parties that want strict curbs on sea arrivals from North Africa.
Alice Adderley. The former US President Donald Trump sells a lot of merchandise. His latest line, his own official trainers, also known as sneakers. He unveiled them just a day after he was fined $355 million in a New York court case. The rubber-soled shoes are called the Never Surrender High Tops, announced by Mr. Trump himself at a sneaker convention in Philadelphia. But as Alfie Habershon reports, the response was mixed, to say the least.
Each and every one of you are going to have an exclusive chance at being one of the first to own this pair of sneakers.
If perfume, pajamas and golf courses weren't enough, Americans can now get their hands on official Donald Trump trainers. The boot-like shoes are a bright and shiny gold, imprinted with a large T where a Nike swoosh might be and an American flag positioned on the ankle. They are selling for almost $400 a pair. At America's biggest annual trainer event on Saturday night, the former president stepped up to the stage, his new trainers proudly in hand but not on his feet, to address a lively audience.
We have a few young ladies that are up here crying. Look at you with the Trump 2024. Thank you, darling. I love you, too. Wow. A lot of emotion. There's a lot of emotion in this room. Thank you.
The Never Surrender High Top sold out within 2 hours of the event, with a special autograph pair going for $90,000 at auction. The extra cash may prove useful for Mr. Trump, who on Friday was fined $355 million in a New York court case after being found to have inflated the value of his own wealth. He is also banned from running any corporation in the state for 3 years, a huge blow to his own image as a New York real estate tycoon. This is in addition to the more than $80 million he has to pay writer E. Jean Carroll after losing a defamation case. All this means an ever-widening line of merchandise may become more important for Mr. Trump, with a costly presidential campaign against Joe Biden already underway. But holding his shoes up high on Saturday night, he said this isn't about any of that, but fulfilling a long-held dream.
This is something I've been talking about for 12 years, 13 years, and I think it's going to be a big success. That's the real deal. That's the real deal.
Donald Trump ending that report by Alfie Habersham. Still to come.
Jane Rose has won equestrian medals for Australia at 3 separate Olympics and is still hoping to go to Paris later this year.
So, why has the Australian Olympic show jumper been suspended from competing? Did his halts falter during the dressage? Find out later.
Who were the Black 14?
14 football players who were at University of Wyoming in 1969.
14 student athletes who paid a heavy price for planning a show of support against racism.
It hit the campus like wildfire.
Some of them was getting death threats.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
It was a complete surprise that he kicked us off the team.
What are we going to do with our lives? How are we going to get our degrees?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Once again, rebel fighters are on the move in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that means another humanitarian crisis is growing. Militants from the M23 rebel group have launched attacks on the town of Sake, which controls the main roads going into the city of Goma. Thousands of people have been displaced. Now, the UN peacekeeping force in the area says it's reinforced its positions around the city. So just how serious, then, is the risk for the people of Goma? I heard more from our Africa regional editor, Julian Bedford.
It's uncertain whether the M23 rebels actually want to take Goma. Goma is a frontier city. It lies on the border with Rwanda. Rwanda are, in many people's eyes, the sponsors of the M23. Bringing a conflict to the front door of Rwanda is not really in their interests. A lot of people think the M23 offensive is more directed towards the south and towards choking off the population of Goma.
So the real threat at the moment lies in the supply lines for goods, food and other things, medicines, to be getting through to Goma, because at the moment that is a very, very dodgy supply line.
M23 control all the roads in and out of Goma, north, south, east and west. They are the masters of logistics. Goma is best resupplied from its immediate neighbourhood or by air. That is a chief threat to close to 2 million people who live in Goma now.
MONUSCO, the UN peacekeeping force, has been in there for pretty much 25 years now. It's going to largely pull out soon. If it does, will it have any impact on security in the region?
I think if you've got a UN peacekeeping force in a region, it raises the profile of the conflict. Eastern Congo is such a huge area with such poor communications. A force, even one as big as 16,000 troops, can do very little. But MONUSCO has been heavily criticised for not taking a proactive approach to the problem. They stay in their barracks, they do patrols, but limited patrols. They aren't out there protecting the local population, and that's what's aroused the ire of the local population. They want to be able to live their lives in peace, and they thought the UN were coming to give them that peace.
Many people also feel that without pressure being put on Rwanda to stop funding the M23 group, no number of peacekeeping troops can provide security.
No, I think you're right. If Rwanda is persuaded to withdraw its support from M23, then that particular conflict will end. But as a student of Eastern Congo, Nick, you'll realise that there are lots of other groups funded by other countries who would just move into the gap. It is very, very lawless in that area. Why? Because of the mineral riches. Everyone knows that they can get rich if they can control territory that has mining in it.
Julian Bedford. Displaced by civil war and then forced to turn to animal feed to survive. That is the situation reportedly faced by some, so say the Darfur 24 news website in Sudan's Darfur region. Well, since civil war erupted across Sudan 10 months ago, millions of people have fled their homes and are now confronted with extreme hunger. Fighting continues between the Sudanese army and the rival paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces. I got more on how it's affecting people from the BBC's Africa correspondent Dorcas Wangira.
The humanitarian situation has been deteriorating. It has been said to be the world's largest displacement crisis. 8 million people have been displaced, and you also have 18 million people who are currently facing extreme hunger. Well, it is a very difficult situation because you have a situation of conflict, and then you have extreme hunger. So you have people fleeing one devastating thing into another. So humanitarian agencies, UNICEF, speaks about 14 million children in need of assistance, and they're looking at 3.5 million children who will suffer from acute malnutrition. There's also a report from MSF from Zamzam in northern Darfur that was released in early February, and their findings were very dire. And they are talking about at least one child dying every 2 hours in Zamzam, and their current estimate is that there are around 13 child deaths each day. I mean, this particular camp in North Darfur.
I mean, that is tragic, obviously. But what are the logistical reasons for this? Is it a lack of aid or an inability of the aid to get through, or a combination of the two?
Well, it is a combination of the two. On Friday, there were reports that there were statements from the Sudanese Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan that he would not allow aid to enter into areas controlled by the RSF forces until he defeats them. And there are also reports from aid agencies that food is being piled up in some areas, and they can't access these areas because they're controlled by the RSF. Well, the situation is urgent because when you have, it's not just the lack of access, but the refusal for aid to get through.
And the situation is on the agenda at the Munich Security Conference in Germany. But the danger is it's going to fall off the radar of global leaders' attention, isn't it?
At this time, what is high on the agenda is Ukraine and even the situation in Gaza. This has been happening in Sudan for months, since April last year. We see reports of people just telling the world, have you forgotten about us? So for us here in Africa, for countries like Chad that are bearing the brunt, when you have a lot of displaced people fleeing, this is not something that they can forget.
That was Dorcas Wangira. Thailand's former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra is back at his mansion in Bangkok following his release on parole. The 74-year-old wealthy businessman served 6 months of a one-year jail term for corruption. He spent every day in a police hospital after complaining of health problems. Well, critics have questioned whether his transfer was justified. Mr. Thaksin, a popular but polarising figure, returned to Thailand last year after 15 years in exile. The Thai government, which oversaw his release, is formed by a reincarnation, as it were, of the party that took Thaksin to power back in 2001. Jonathan Head, the BBC's correspondent in Bangkok, was there 20 years ago, and he's been following Thaksin's progress ever since. Owen Bennett-Jones asked him if Thaksin Shinawatra is still a potent political force.
No, he's not. At least that's my view. Look, nobody would ever discount Thaksin Shinawatra. He's an abrasive, ambitious man with a tremendous sense of destiny. But he has been ground down in those 15 years in exile. He desperately wanted to come back. His party has been dissolved twice. His sister was ousted she was pushed out and ousted by a coup. Then she had a jail sentence imposed on her, as he's had. There's been a steady sort of attrition against the Shinawatra family, even though his party kept winning elections. But more importantly, at the last election that we saw in Thailand last year, for the first time, his party did not win. It was kind of outclassed by a much bolder new young reformist party, Move Forward, that actually won the election. But then the same royalists who've been blocking Thaksin all these years blocked Move Forward from taking power and seem to have decided that, given that he's a diminished figure, they can afford to let him back and give him leniency, which is what we've seen today.
Does he understand his own diminishment?
I don't know. I mean, from all my experience of dealing with Mr. Thaksin, it's not sure. But I suspect in some ways he does. Look, he's very important in his party, and his party is technically in power. His own man, a businessman called Seta Thabisin, is the prime minister. But it's a coalition government in which his party barely has half the seats. And he's in coalition with the very people who've been bitterly fighting him, the hardline royalist conservatives. It's a marriage of convenience between these two. It's a messy government. They've made promises they may not be able to keep. Most people see his populist party, which dominated Thai politics for 15 years, very much as a declining force now, as Thais look for something different.
Yeah, and it's not easy to be populist when many people think he had quite a soft time of it in prison. You know, smaller sentence, in a hospital, parole quite quickly, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and look, they did a deal. We all know that. A deal was done with the people he'd been fighting against all these years to bring him back. He's a very rich man. He's got lots of residences. He's got tons of money. He can live very comfortably. His political base were largely the sort of poor and lower middle class, particularly in the areas outside Bangkok, who passionately believed he would change their lives. I think looking at his party in this messy coalition government and him now out of prison after a deal, it's very likely that his star is waning.
Jonathan Head. Oppenheimer, the three-hour epic about the making of the atomic bomb, has won the prize for Best Film at the British Film Awards in London. The movie, which had the most nominations at the BAFTAs, scooped 7 awards in total. Christopher Nolan took Best Director prize, whilst the Best Actor went to Cillian Murphy for his eponymous role in the biopic. The film also saw Robert Downey Jr. walk away with the Best Supporting Actor gong. But the biggest hit at the box office last year, Barbie, failed to win an award. Colin Paterson mingled with the stars on the red carpet at the Royal Festival Hall in London.
BAFTA goes to Oppenheimer.
It was Oppenheimer's night at the BAFTAs. The three-hour historical epic about the creation of the atomic bomb won 7 awards, including Best Film, Best Director for Christopher Nolan, while Best Actor went to Cillian Murphy for playing the title role.
Oppenheimer was this colossally knotty, complex character, and he meant different things to different people, and, you know, one man's monster is another man's hero.
Robert Downey Jr. was named Best Supporting Actor for his role as a member of the Atomic Energy Commission wanting to halt Oppenheimer's influence. This win came 31 years after his only previous BAFTA for Chaplin, the longest gap between triumphs in the award show's history.
I am Bella Baxter, and there is a world to enjoy.
The twisted steampunk fantasy Poor Things won 5, with Emma Stone named Best Actress for the second time in her career.
I just want to start by thanking our dialect coach, Neil Swain, because I was playing a British person in this movie, and he did not laugh at me when he taught me how to say water even though as an American, I say it like water.
And The Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer's German language film about the family life of a Nazi commander living over the wall at Auschwitz, became the first film in BAFTA history to win both Outstanding British Film and Film Not in English. There was a standing ovation for Michael J. Fox, who has had Parkinson's disease for more than 30 years and was the surprise presenter of Best Film.
Thank you very much.
However, Barbie, despite being the biggest film of the year, won nothing. Next, in 3 weeks' time, the Oscars.
Colin Paterson at the British Film Awards in London. An Australian Olympic show jumper has been suspended from competing. That's after he wore a mankini at an event. Complaints were made about his skimpy attire whilst he was riding a horse near Sydney. Steve Jackson takes up the tale.
Shane Rose has won equestrian medals for Australia at three separate Olympics and is still hoping to go to Paris later this year. He was taking part in a competition in New South Wales, in which riders had been encouraged to wear extraordinary costumes. But the sight of the 50-year-old show jumping in a day-glow orange mankini was apparently too much for someone. The sport's governing body in Australia has stopped him from competing while it investigates complaints. Several of Shane Rose's fellow Olympic show jumpers have accused Equestrian Australia of overreacting.
Steve Jackson reporting. And if you don't know what a mankini is, look it up. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.